this concept of stars and lights and physics, and you could explain it and it could make sense to you. Like, that was something that attracted me a lot, is something that you could really make sense out of and explain, and had like a model that you were trying to understand. It was very grounding. Whereas me, why was like there as a Chinese immigrant, all that, and why would people look at me and stare at me? That didn't make sense. So I found solace in science and reading.
Hello, first-time founders. My name is Stacy.
And I'm Maria.
And we are the hosts of the Dear First-Time Founders podcast.
Through the conversations with our incredible founders, we will talk about their journey of navigating the two F words in Silicon Valley, fear and failure.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Maria Sipka, and welcome back to Dear First Time Founders podcast, where we sit down to have an intimate conversation with our multiple time founders. Today, we're elated to welcome a very extraordinary technology entrepreneur, Diana Hu. Diana's superpower is inventing and building the future. From a very young age, she has immersed herself in alternate realities. And through skill, intelligence, and hard work, she became an early pioneer in augmented reality. And what's rare about Diana is that she's created significant impact as a technologist. Here's just some of her most notable roles. She was a data scientist at Intel, where she led and started the machine learning and computer vision group. She co-founded and she was a CTO at Escher Reality, where she built the most advanced augmented reality API. This company was incubated at Y Combinator and then sold to Niantic just a few years after launching. And at Niantic, she oversaw all of the AR teams building core AI tech used in games like Pokemon Go and Harry Potter. As a female technology entrepreneur based in the Valley, it's rare to meet a fellow female that has a title of data scientist or head of engineering or CTO. And so just to give you a taste of some of the themes that we're going to dig into today as we learn more about Diana is the sense of being a part of a community beyond one's ego, creating a space for vulnerability for the founders community and the inner growth journey. So, Diana, let's dig in. Your parents immigrated to Chile from China, and the first time you had access to a computer, you were 14. And by 16, you landed in the US, not speaking any English. And then shortly after, you were studying engineering at Carnegie Mellon. What were some of the earlier influences in your life that led you into your passion for technology?
That is such an awesome intro, Maria, by the way. I gotta say, it's like, wow, not really cool, really awesome. Now, talking a bit about early influences, I think something that stands out for me has always been very curious. And perhaps even because we lived in, when my parents immigrated to Chile, they did not go to the big city, Santiago, which is the capital. They went and picked some of the most remote city in the middle of the Atacama Desert, which is actually one of the driest desert in the world. It's so dry and so foreign that actually NASA used to do tests for the rover mission to Mars, because that's the most Mars-like environment in planet Earth. Anyway, so long story short, very remote place. I think when I grew up, we were the only Chinese family, probably in a 300-mile radius. So I was very in tune of always being very different, because Chile is also very homogeneous, so I would always stand out. So I kept a lot to myself. That was one thing. And I think I spent a lot of time in my inner world. I was still being curious, and I used to really like reading a lot. So a lot of stories and literature in Spanish. That's kind of what nurtured me when I was young, to kind of escape a little bit, because it was kind of very uncomfortable to be the always the different person. I love science too. And because Chile had these beautiful clear skies and some of the best telescopes in the world, and our telescopes that are just in the desert around there. And I used to really be into learning about cosmology and the universe. And that was like another passion that perhaps I wanted to grow up and be an astronomer. Just the curiosity of what is this phenomenon of life in the universe, of this concept of stars and light and physics, and you could explain it and it could make sense to you. Like, that was something that attracted me a lot, is something that you could really make sense out of and explain and had like a model that you were trying to understand. It was very grounding. Whereas me, why was like there as a Chinese immigrant, all that, and why would people look at me and stare at me? That didn't make sense. So I found solace in science and reading. I used to also love animals. So one of my favorite channels to watch was a lot of Animal Planet. And I used to be able to name all the animals and know all these random facts about them. So as part of this curiosity, I've always been, I suppose, very good geek, like different obsessions in my life that I got super deep into. It's been something part of me. And because I also had a lot of free time as a child, I would cause troubles too if I wasn't kind of immersed in something. So my parents just gave me like books and things like keep me busy. Otherwise, I would make a mess in the home. Like I would tear things apart, take them apart, and probably not put them together. I don't know how to put them together all the time. So all these telephones were taken apart, screws all over the place. So I was entertained this other way.
That's really inspiring. I mean, for a young child to be fascinated in space and with the books that your parents were giving you, were you accessing any content online at that stage? I don't know if this was before you were 14 or after 14.
Well, this is before 14. This is before 14. 14, that opened a whole new world too. And I think it made learning a lot easier as well.
Wow. It's just such a fine art to not have access to technology as a child and be boundless in terms of your creativity and sense of adventure. And it, you know, when we shift into technology and the path that you took and your curiosity and being one of the earlier pioneers in augmented reality, for those listeners who are not familiar with augmented reality, can you give us a short introduction to AR? Like, what is it? Why is it a growing field?
Well, AR is a very interesting next phase in computing. So if you think about the evolution of computing, started with desktop computing, then it went into mobile, and then this world, what we call a mixed reality with augmented reality and virtual reality or the metaverse, is where is the future is coming to be. And more specifically, what AR is the ability to, as the word calls it, augment your physical world with digital information. And what that translates to is having the ability to overlay digital information into any physical surface. So right now with phone or desktop, all your digital information just comes out of the screen. In here, you have the potential for anything to be a screen, not just a screen, but in 3D. So the way you can project information becomes a lot more interesting and all ways of interesting ways of interacting. So that's what augmented reality is. It got a lot very popular because of Pokemon Go, because it built this game and this feature, seeing your Pokemon in the real world, that was very visceral. So the ability to connect with information at this whole new level is what AR is.
What are some other examples of AR applications that we would know today, and paint a vision of where it's heading?
Well, today AR is more accessible to consumers via the phone. So there's things with the face filters that you see from Snapchat, perhaps. That's one form of AR. Other form of AR that might be, if you have tried a couple apps on the phone with like IKEA, where you place digital furniture and see how it fits in your room, that has been another application. Now, maybe other applications more on the industrial side that are maybe less familiar for consumers is the ability to explain if you have a explain where different parts go. If you need this giant machine that's hard to repair, you could overlay all the information of what this part means, where it's supposed to go. If you have a gazillion of screws, like where does this go? It helps teach technicians. So AR has been also helpful too for teaching. There's other applications for visualizing anatomy for your body and learning all the organs and where they are and really see it in 3D. It connects. So there's some other examples.
Any examples in the emotion, in the emotional mindfulness area?
So the thing is, with augmented reality, I think the application in the future will be very, very practical. I think where AR is going is sort of where computing has gone in our work life, is the ability to see and work with information anywhere. So AR is going more in that direction, which I think is, has a huge opportunity. Whereas VR, now connecting to the emotion and mindfulness aspect of it, is more, you're kind of more escaping into reality. But I think it has the ability to create more of emotional reactions to people, because some of the best experience I actually had on VR was this beautiful experience from created from the Stanford lab, where you're experiencing the life of someone you grow up, and you go through life and you experience getting bullied, and you feel that getting bullied when you're a young kid, or when you're in a sports team, you know how they pick sports team and you're supposed to, they pick you or don't pick you. You experience the rejection of not getting selected for a team. You grow up through this. So you grow up, that was teenage. Later you start, go to college and you graduate and try to get a job. And you go through 5-10 interviews and you keep getting rejected. And I'm going to spoil the ending, but what you, at the end of this experience in VR, which is fully immersive, you have spatial audio, you see it, you are as if you're experiencing this person's life because you see it from their perspective. You look at yourself at the mirror and you're this black man. And that is so powerful because it really connects, and I think much needed right now with everything that we're going to help people empathize. So I think VR has this sensibility. So just contrasting it with AR is more practical. With VR, there's I think, a lot of potential with such applications to open up empathy and experiencing other, literally you're walking in someone else's shoe, literally.
What I'm hearing is that it has potential to impact the consciousness of the planet in a scalable way by connecting people with each other and connecting them with their deep trauma and with the healing mechanisms that are being put into place. And that's just, that's really heart-blowing, actually. Wow. Tell us about your first company, Escher Reality, which was acquired by Niantic in 2018. What motivated you to start this company?
Yeah, so I was talking a bit of those obsessions that I go through life. Part of being, I suppose it's just part of who I am, getting deep into something. I think it started with being very curious about where computer vision was going. That's one intersection with all these papers that were coming out of academia with this particular method called SLAM, that stands for Simultaneous Localization and Mapping, that's used for robots to know where they are in the world and localize. So what it does is you have a robot, if you don't have any of your senses, you need to kind of build where you are in the world. So it builds a map and then you're able to have the robot navigate and come back. So that technology uses cameras and builds these 3D maps. It's the same technology behind self-driving cars, actually, for knowing where they are so they can navigate. There was this technology that was really, I think, ripe and ready, but it was still very much in academia land. And then the other trend we're seeing was that mobile devices were getting so powerful in computing and power efficiency. You had an iPhone from even back then, 2016, 15. It was just as computationally powerful as a MacBook from a year ago, but at a fraction of the power. So that was kind of the aha, that that you have enough computation finally in a mobile device to be able to run these algorithms, and what would happen if you did. So that's supposed part of the curiosity maze that started with. And it was part of exploring and see whether this was possible at all to run these algorithms on the phone. And then we found it was, and then building more the vision. Okay, now you have that locally. Now, what if you overlay this concept of a cloud, a distributed system behind it, that you just don't have your local map? A lot of robots just do with the little local map. But what if you start building a global map so you could localize anywhere and start building a service around it? Then it becomes this powerful kind of foundation to enable AR to happen, because for AR to happen, you need digital content to really anchor in the real world and remember and come back. So you needed all this foundation. There's a long explanation, but that's kind of what it is.
Fascinating. And that led you to starting the company. I know that when you got accepted into Y Combinator, you said, hey, we're actually not going to be generating any revenue for some time. And that's really rare. That's like a dream in Silicon Valley, to be able to launch a company and say to your investors, like, we're not going to be generating any revenue, and then to actually exit your company to one of the greatest game developers in the world. How did that opportunity come about?
I think as part of working on deep tech is you're really inventing here what's not been there. We knew what we were about. So we were upfront with conversations with our investors. Like, we're not going to hide with anything here. We're still building foundational tech. It will take a while. And all of them were on board. All of the people that backed us. And coming into the Niantic conversation, we got a lot of interest after around demo day for what we were doing, because we had some of the most impressive demos with AR being cross-platform, working not just iOS, but also Android, and with the AR cloud and multiplayer. We got tons of interest. And the Niantic conversation came about because we were introduced actually by a mutual investor. And we started the conversations more around wanting to have Niantic as a customer. And the conversations evolved from there, that we got on board on what they were building for the future, and they wanted to build this with the team and how it could integrate with the game more in a kind of vertical way. Then that was then a great option. It's going to be strategic. The other thing that was exciting about Niantic at that point was that it was, as opposed to we got interest from other big companies, which they're public and they're tens of thousands of people, let's say. Niantic was very different. They were still a startup. Like, when we talked to them, they just had this hit with Pokemon Go, and the company was tiny. They were less than 100 people. So for us to come in and build this still felt like a startup journey. And really, we got the alignment was we got to build the same roadmap we had in mind. We were empowered to continue to do it. So that was exciting. And de-risking the aspect of having to fundraise again. We're essentially built within Niantic, and we would have customers right away, and it was going to make this vision a lot faster. So we joined, and Niantic was around 100 people when we came in, and then it was going through this hyper growth trajectory over the next couple of years since then. It's sort of skipping the Series A startup and going to hyper growth, because we
just very smart.
So that was very smart. Appealing.
I imagine that you built many AR projects, or did you focus on just one?
There were multiple different AR projects at Niantic, yes.
So what's one that you can be really proud of, one that you found extremely exhilarating and exciting? And tell us about that particular project.
I think an exciting project more than anything is shipping into Pokemon Go, because Pokemon Go is this huge following and now cultural phenomenon. So from the time that you launch, any tech needs to be able to handle the load of users. Like, by that time, Pokemon Go was already stable, didn't have all those server crashes at the beginning. So anything that went in need to be able to handle all the hundreds of millions of users. So that was more of an engineering achievement to be proud of, that we launched the multiplayer service and we had zero hiccups. it launched, it was flawlessly. I mean, it was a lot of work at the beginning. It was all messy and we had all those late nights too. But once it was launched, it was so, we built it so well that we didn't have any fires and still stable to this day. So that was awesome. That was one project that just felt good, just from kind of the achievement side of it. Other project that I was very proud of in Niantic was when we steered Niantic to be not just a gaming company, because Azure has the DNA of serving developers. Those were our core users. And we brought that DNA into Niantic and started the Niantic Real World platform, which is more using all this technology that power Pokemon Go and open it up to other developers to just use it to build interesting experiences. So they don't have to build all this ground up that we spent so many years building, all this advanced tech. We got $1 million worth in prize and launching it and finding game studios and then having games that succeeded. And now they're getting incubated at Niantic. That was another effort that was awesome.
What a legacy. Really, really inspiring. What I also find really inspiring is just your sense of community. You're a female founder in a male-dominated field. And everything that I've read about you is that you're unstoppable. You dream really big. And you're also extremely humble. Tell us about how you developed and nurtured your community.
I must say, I don't think it's something I consider myself like great at. I know some people that are just forces of nature and community building, like Kiri. I think it has been something more honed. I think it was subconscious at the beginning because it was by need to build companies and teams. And over the last couple of years, it's been something more in the forefront to bring it on. And how it's been done, I think it's still a process of trying to learn and build it. I think at the end, my learning is that you could have, let's say, a work relationship may seem that it's just at that particular instance, like it's just this work engagement for this one company and just this relationship, and then it ends, and it's just finite. The learning I've been having in Revelation is that in reality, all of these relationships are more infinite. Even though you connected in this one instance, in this context of work, you don't know. Life is infinite and you connect with someone later on and they switch roles and there's so much more. So this concept of sometimes people being okay with burning bridges, I'm totally not okay with that. Because there's something about how we're all connected to each other that comes back later. And is I think what's more important to me right now, instead of winning at that one time, whatever you're trying to optimizing in that instance, it's not worth it to compromise it. I'd rather be keep getting invited in the future to what that might be in that relationship. It could be working together again in the next company or even just mentoring. I think that's a lot more valuable rather than, I know some people want to do the whole climb up and they're okay with burning bridges or being very cutthroat. I think I really change to that. And some of the best relationship now is some of the that I continue mentoring, some of the people that I've been unknown for years, for almost a decade, some of them in some cases.
Beautiful. This notion of abundance and looking at community as this infinite connectedness. What I really love about community building is that everybody contributes something. And so in reflecting on yourself, what are some of your unique qualities that you were able to bring into the community and the effect that you were able to have on others that no doubt leads to you being invited back to every single community that you've been part of?
It's funny. I recently had this very uncomfortable exercise as part of Second Time Founder, sending a survey of finding your zone of genius. And there's some questions in there. What sort of reliably shows up in the room when I'm around, and what are the top three things that come up that you see in me? So that's reflecting what other people have seen, which I think reaffirmed things that I knew about myself, but it also got me to be more confident about them. Some of them were a lot of this kind of calmness and quiet confidence, and they call it more of soft power, which is interesting. It's just the position of these two very opposite words, but I think they really reflect part of who I am, because I'm not the type to have, I don't have like a big presence in social media. I'm not the loudest person in the room. That's not me. But I know what I stand for, and I don't have to like show it off per se. That's not something that I've done. And I think it has to be with roots of growing up as a model minority and not knowing what it is until later, learned this term of not standing out, because it's can be dangerous if you stand out too much.
Fascinating. Well, as I said, you're humble and you're unstoppable. You talk a lot about vulnerability. Hallelujah. Vulnerability has become one of the most present themes in leadership, thanks to leaders and heart warriors like Brené Brown. And Brené says, vulnerability is not winning or losing, which is what you've just mentioned. It's about having the courage to show up when you can't control the outcome. And that is so you, what we've just heard. Yeah, like you're like, it's not, you know, it's not about winning or losing. You just show up into a space. So as you've been maybe experimenting with vulnerability, would love to understand what does vulnerability mean to you? How do you create a space for vulnerability in the founders community? Like what we'd love to learn from you, just your experience around this topic.
Yeah, I think this is such a hard topic, because I think for, let's say, first-time founder, there's so much of this thirst to succeed at all cost. And a lot of times as a startup too, there's a little contradicting aspect of it. Like by default, every startup at the beginning, the default of it is to be unknown and to by default die, because a lot of startups, statistically, not many of them are going to make it, per se, quote unquote. So there's so much they have to do to fight that. And to kind of at least, there's this thing about fake it until you make it kind of thing. Sometimes it's too much. I think it's a balance. You need a little bit, but not too much. So there's a bit of that. And I think when you're in that facade of too much fake it until you make it, can hide a lot of real struggles that sometimes as you unveil them, you could be able to resolve them if you're comfortable sharing them or inspiring someone else's journey. So there's a bit of that opposing forces, like success, picking that you make it, appearing confident where you need to fundraise or hire a team, because as a leader too, you're supposed to know where you're going, right? All those like, what are you supposed to do? Because as an entrepreneur, you're supposed to be number one cheerleader too. I think there's time and place to do that. Part of it is when you're 100% just that. I think it can weaken this other part of when you have to have the tough conversations and be real. I think that's becomes difficult. And how can you create those spaces? I think it's like a dance. You kind of get to kind of touch the waters here and there, because not everyone is comfortable with it. And as you get closer, you can have like a more closer embrace, let's say we use the dance analogy. But it also starts with, it gets in positions of leadership in startups when you see more people being comfortable publicly admitting certain things that are very, very vulnerable. I think it signals also the rest of the team and the company that it's okay to do it. So those moments are critical when a leader can and when it makes sense, because sometimes there's such thing as too much of it too. I think it's a balance. It's when does it feel right to do it and to share? Yeah, like at least in my management style, I have developed very deep relationships with a lot of people I work with and reports, and some of them have shared very, very, very intimate things that they wouldn't share with other people that they would have known. And part of it is just listening as well is the big one. Before, I think what Brené Brown said about just showing up, I would add another one. I think before that is also listening, I think is the big one.
Beautiful. So on that point of sharing and vulnerability, can you think of a moment of truth where you've stood in the crucible of your own fear and discomfort as a founder, as a human being? Can you share with us this moment and how you are able to overcome it?
I think there's just so many. One recent one is, as I've been going through this transition of starting another company, part of the uncomfortableness is being restless and being okay with this chaos, because I've been in this mode of operating. You have this vision, you know what you're doing and the strategy, and now it's this chaos mode, the best way I can describe it. And I think that's what is actually needed to explore, to find what aligns for this next company.
What mindset or mind training tool or habit has been really effective for you as a founder?
I've been getting more over the last couple of years deeper into the space. Before, as being maybe too scientific, I didn't believe in it too much. It was like too soft. It doesn't make sense. All these things with kind of mindfulness. But I've noticed really a difference. Part of it is really having a practice. That is a practice. Sometimes I lose it. Some weeks is consistent. That has been one that really gets me to be aware of where I am and the inner, how it manifests outside. That is one I can think of. Other ones are, I think, just in general, more aware of, in general, self-care, like operating at your peak, which has to do with basic things, but really tracking sleep, consistency of sleep, consistency of meals, consistency of exercise. It's as basic as that sounds. Just doing those actually have gotten me to be much better. Been optimizing my, I don't know if this is my tool necessarily, but consistent sleep hours and those. Drinking water as well, mindfully.
How many hours sleep do you get, and how much water do you drink? Let's get to brass tacks. It's a good reminder. All of this is a great reminder.
Yeah, actually it's about 8 hours or sometimes more. It's funny because I don't know. I think my younger self used to be maybe proud. It's like, oh, I work so hard that I don't need sleep. It's the thing. Or as a student, even maybe way, way back, you have all these like sometimes cramming through a night and not getting sleep and going to exam the next day. That's not something I can do now. But being aware of that, how much it impacts you, it has been a shift on that. In terms of water, I think it's about roughly 8 cups a day. So there's 2 in the morning and 2 at night. I've been kind of very engineer about it. 1 during lunch, 1 during dinner, etc.
Well, you use a lot of brain power. You're starting a new company. You also advise and invest into other companies. Tell us about just emerging from having your own startup, selling it to a company like Niantic that was a rocket ship. And then that time that you pull away, you give yourself space to find your new company. But now you're intentional about companies where you want to invest in time and money. Tell us about that journey.
Yeah, absolutely. I know with investing, it can be because there's just so many spaces you could go into. I've made a choice of going into spaces where I can contribute. I want to be helpful to founders. So I go into spaces that I have an expertise in. So in computer vision, machine learning, AR, VR has been mostly, or developer infrastructure. And I like to work with founders who have a deep tech angle. So I like problems that have startup tackling technical challenges. One of the companies is building a new programming language. So that's like an ambitious goal. other one is building this awesome VR application too. And other one is working with computer vision data to automate and get better in kitchens, which is a very different application. So those are some of the ones.
And what are some of the traits or qualities that you're looking for in a founder before you make a commitment to invest your time and money?
A couple of things, because knowing that this journey can be 10 years, is this someone that I feel happy to back for and be related to in the next 10 years. That's kind of one, my basic one. The other ones is just in general, not just founders, but people that I work with. I think a lot of people that are really growth oriented, really hungry on that and wanting to continue better themselves and always in the lookout for something and improving themselves. So that's one. So kind of getting a sense of what keeps their attention motivated. Other ones is standard, kind of more investor thinking of their market, the team, the product. And another big one, which I think, I don't know many people do, but this concept of a product founder fit is like, is this the best person to build this? Like sometimes you can have an awesome person, but this what they're doing is not really fit who they are and their DNA. I think that's another relationship I look at a lot.
How many companies can you advise and be building your own company at the same time?
Yeah. So right now, the building of the company for me has been up and down. It's been a couple iterations of ideas. So that hasn't picked up yet. I think I know once it picks up more, I would do probably less of the advising and investing.
Mm-hmm. So as we wrap up here, just a couple of more questions. What's the one advice that you would give to aspiring first-time founders?
Well, I think even though this is the first company, don't think of it, this is the end of it all. There's much more than this first company. Think about the relationship you're building. Who you pick to work with, they make so much difference on your day-to-day fulfillment. So that's number one.
That's a really important one. Can you just elaborate on that a little more? How do you even go about selecting either your co-founder or the first few people that you're working with? What have you learned from your experience?
There's trade-offs because as a startup, I know you want to, there's definitely the skill set piece that you try and I know sometimes optimize too much for just that the only criteria. But is this someone that you want to spend 24/7 more than your life partner with, let's say? Would you be okay with that and would you enjoy that time? Is this someone that you share values with? I think especially for, let's say, co-founder relationship, maybe you may want to ask those questions that you're not supposed to ask in an interview. Like it's not legal to ask, but things like, what do they believe, their religion and the views on politics or et cetera, all these things you're not supposed to ask. I think it does build some foundation of understanding too, being aware of that. That's kind of part of it. Like is this someone you can see yourself have a long relationship?
Yeah, it gives you an insight into the person's story and what they value. And it's not necessarily about making a judgment based on what religion or political party, but it's just really digging underneath that and understanding more about the journey or the path or the influences that that person has had. And it's all about diversity and inclusion, of course, as we build our companies today, which is really exciting to see. And so you have a much deeper level of respect when you have that level of diversity in your company.
Absolutely. You're not looking for someone who believes exactly what you believe in. It's actually much better to get different perspective, but it makes it so much better if you understand the context to be able to listen more and, oh, they're coming from this angle. Okay, makes sense. And you didn't, that whole aspect of it, which sometimes I think with some cultures and startups tend to select for too much of the same. There has to be enough of the, I think you have to be conscious of the things you want more of the same, not just let it be an afterthought. Like what are the aspects of the DNA and culture of your company that you want more of? What should be more diversified? And know that like you could say basic things like we want everyone who follows through with their work is very independent, is curious, is good at what they do, and you would want to work with them regardless. That could be what more of, but all the other things, you don't have to include other things that could be very homogeneous in that bucket.
Mm-hmm. Is there a favorite book or podcast that you can share with our audience?
There's so many. I think in terms of podcasts, I haven't been listening to too many recently. But in terms of, I really like the series from Jerry Colonna from Reboot.
And a book that you're reading today?
So a book I've been quote-unquote reading, I guess, is the Alinea Cookbook by this chef in Chicago who's super creative. So that's what I've been getting into. And the Modernist Cuisine is another one.
Yeah, I noticed that you're passionate about hydroponic plants, which is awesome.
And oh, yeah, that was the previous phase. I didn't go through phases of what I get super into.
Wow, dinner at your place. Diana, I love your commitment to creating impact in the world and the value you place in building tribes and communities. I love your courage and deep sense of curiosity, listening and learning and growing. I can wholeheartedly say that our world is a more connected place physically and virtually because of you. You're an inspiration, and thank you so much for sharing so much of you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Maria, for making this seamless. You're an awesome host and asking all these questions in a very thoughtful and had a thoughtful way, and it had an arc. You can see the story arc too, like, oh.
Thank you so much for listening to our episode. We'll come back with more inspirational stories Friday night, bi-weekly, wherever you find your podcast.
And if you feel inspired and want to connect more with our founders, please follow us, Second Time Founders, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you, and we will see you all in the next episode.